United States Supreme Court is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Annette T. Ziegler presiding. Silence is commanded.
All right, please be seated. Good morning. We are here for oral argument this morning, but we do have a class here with us, with the Court with Class program, the UW-Madison Pre-Law Society. If you could rise, please. Just want to say welcome. We are happy to have you here today. I believe Justice Ann Walsh Bradley is available to speak with you over the noon hour, if you have time to come back and do that. But welcome. It's nice to have you here. Go ahead and have a seat. All right. The first case, I'm going to ask counsel what's the pronunciation? Okay. State versus Moldy. Could I have your appearances, please?
Yes. Assistant Attorney General
Jay Sigler. All right. Good morning. The lineup I have is 25 minutes, followed by 30 minutes, and 5 minutes in rebuttal. Right? Okay, with that, please proceed.
Chief Justice, may it please the court. State asked for a review in this case to address a certain kind of testimony of whether it constitutes Hazeltine testimony. And the testimony here is expert statistical testimony about the incidence of false reports of sexual assault. And three cases have popped up in the Court of Appeals over the last 10 years or so that address this issue, and I'm glad that the court has decided to take a look at it to see if these cases are correctly decided. The main case is Mader, and Mader holds effectively that statistical testimony alone that 8% or less of child sexual assaults reports are false constitutes Hazeltine testimony. The state submits this is incorrect, that Hazeltine itself says that no witness, expert, or lay may offer an opinion about whether another witness is telling the truth. And statistical testimony alone does not offer any opinion about whether another witness is telling the truth. It takes additional evidence or it takes additional connections between the statistics and the victim in the case to convey an opinion. So that the state is asking first that that part of Mader be overturned. Second, the next mistake that Mader made was to say in 2023 that in holding that this sort of testimony for the first time is Hazeltine testimony, that while in fact it was actually well established in 2019 that this sort of testimony was Hazeltine testimony. And because that wasn't the case, there wasn't well settled law at either Mader's trial or Moldy's trial, which was in 2019. So we would ask that you overturn that part of Mader as well. And finally, if this court disagrees with both of those positions, it should nonetheless reverse the Court of Appeals because the non-objection was not prejudicial in this case. That the defendant can't demonstrate a reasonable likelihood of a different outcome in this case absent this testimony.
Can I ask you a question about Mader?
Yes.
What part of Mader would you have us keep? I really don't mean to be funny, but I'm
correctly decided. We'll leave that, okay? Because it's legal rule. Its legal rules on this area are incorrect, but there's a whole lot of other stuff in Mader that addresses legal challenges. There were multiple claims that were raised, and ultimately, its holding is correct because there was no prejudice in Mader. It's a very clear case. The evidence was overwhelming that presented at trial, and so when I say overturn Mader in part, I'm talking about the part of Mader that has the most impact, of course, and that's its holding that this sort of expert testimony, if it's 8% or less, well, that's a victim in this case is telling the truth.
Okay, so the other evidentiary objections you don't have a problem with that the court upheld. Okay.
What should we make of the fact that Dr. Swenson supervised the interview here? And, you know, under what circumstances do you think that that could be a problem? Even if, and let me just add a caveat, even assuming that your argument that statistics by itself doesn't necessarily constitute impermissible vouching, are there circumstances where the relationship between the person testifying might cross that boundary, and what would that look like, and how should we think about that?
Well, I think, first of all, I think the fact that in this case she didn't ever meet the victim, she supervised the examination, didn't do an evaluation herself, she just supervised the person who did. That person was going to testify at trial, but she was unavailable, and so her supervisor, Dr. Swenson, testified. I think in cases in which there is a more direct connection where, for instance, let's say that a person who evaluates people who are victims of sexual assault on a regular basis evaluates the victim in the case, then they're asked the question, so how often do children make up these sort of allegations? And they provide a testimony from their own experience. So they say, well, in fact, it's extremely rare, and I've only had one case in my history in which I've had a child not tell the truth. I think that that's vouching because the doctor examined the victim in this case. She's testifying for the state. She says that in only one case was a victim not telling the truth. I think the clear implication there is that she believes it's the clear inference is that she has an opinion that this victim is telling the truth. So, and that's actually similar to one of the witnesses in Mader. There were two witnesses in Mader, one who just offered plain vouching testimony. He was a police officer, investigator, who said, I've investigated 150 of these kind of cases, and I've only had one person not tell the truth. And he said that he repeatedly interviewed this particular victim. Well, that's an opinion that this victim is telling the truth. So,
Go ahead. Okay. Would you agree then it depends on, yes, the relationship, but also maybe how the question's asked? Here we had a jury question. But maybe it would, even if they didn't say, I've interviewed this many people and this many people lied, there could be a situation perhaps where the timing of the questioning right after talking about the victim could lead to some kind of insinuation of vouching.
Right. Some of the Hazeltine cases, not all of them, but many of them talk about what the purpose and the effect of the testimony is. And this goes to that analysis. You know, here in this case, the state had no intention of eliciting this sort of testimony. It didn't, you know, it knew that it was going to call an expert, and it, you know, said this is what the expert is going to talk about and didn't say anything in particular about this kind of testimony. And so the state didn't intend to offer it. So it didn't this definitely doesn't satisfy the purpose part of the analysis. I would argue, too, that it doesn't satisfy the effect either. Because this testimony was not connected at all to this particular victim. So there isn't a reasonable inference that you can draw from this testimony that's just numbers, that's just statistics, that this particular victim is telling the truth.
So, counsel, let me ask you this. Right out of Hazeltine, the language that I find very strong is, quote, the jury is the lie detector in the courtroom, right? The jury's the lie detector in the courtroom. And I understand 99% is the statistic, right? I didn't hear anything or see anything in the record that told us how the witness got to 99%. No studies, no other information. And when I combine that with that 99% statistic, I want you to talk a little bit about the prejudicial effect, but I'm really concerned. How can that not be deficient performance?
Sure. First of all, there's a lot there. respond to.
Yeah.
It really goes to the heart of the case. First off, the 99%, because this comes out, you know, as an answer to a question from a juror, no preparation whatsoever. She's offering what I think, there's no indication that she's, like, not telling the truth, that this is what she honestly remembers from the research. She says, when she's cross-examined by defense counsel, this is what I recall from the studies that I've read. So that's where she gets the information from. So there was no opportunity for the state to offer, you know, as it would pretrial, studies. And I've discussed some of the studies in a footnote in my brief. They're not in the record. There's a reason I kept it in a footnote. but I just want you to know that those studies are out there, and that they actually reflect closely the testimony of the expert in Mader. So for your review of the Mader decision, I think those may be relevant. But going to the question of whether this has a prejudicial effect, I think that it does not for multiple reasons. First, it's not actually an opinion about whether this person is telling the truth. Second, jurors, I was surprised in taking a look at the transcript again at the instructions that were given by the judge and looking at the standard instruction, which is jury instruction 300 for credibility of witnesses. This is one of the main jobs that trial judges, as you know, have, is telling jurors that, hey, it's your responsibility to decide what the facts are, decide the credibility of the witnesses. And it's not just that they're repeatedly, at least three different times in three different ways, told how you're supposed to determine credibility, that it's your responsibility, use your common sense, and so on. They're provided detailed instructions about how to do that. These are the kinds of ways that you can, these are how you determine whether someone is telling the truth or not. This is just common sense stuff that we tell jurors to do. So I think in this case, this is not a situation where, let's say at trial there's some kind of testimony that comes out that's not supposed to come out, and so it's objected to, and then there's some curative instruction. You heard testimony about pink elephants. Don't think about this pink elephant. You know, don't consider it in your deliberations. Here, there's detailed instructions on how you're supposed to determine credibility. So I think that goes to prejudice as well. I think that that it's not opinion testimony. Here, it's also not for the purpose, again, because the state didn't offer it. It was in response to a question. So,
counsel, you said this is what she honestly remembers from the research. But that isn't sufficient to have this kind of testimony offered. 90702 sub 1 requires more foundation. It requires that the testimony is based on sufficient facts or data. The testimony is the product of reliable principles and methods, and the witness has applied the principles and methods reliably to the facts of this case. The record doesn't support these foundational requirements having been met. And this is what she honestly remembers from the record, I doubt is sufficient to meet those standards.
Yes, I'm going to agree with you.
Good.
if we were here and the state had tried, and this was all that the state offered, pre-trial to introduce this evidence, this would not be sufficient. But we're not here in that posture. The posture that we're in right now is that there's a question from a juror. The state did not intend to offer it.
Does the question from the juror relieve the court of its gatekeeping responsibilities under Daubert?
No, it doesn't, but that was addressed in the post-conviction decision. The court, in its post-conviction decision, now, before I address, I'll say this. In the court's post-conviction decision, it says that if an objection had been offered, it suggests that if an objection had been offered, it would have rejected the objection because this was a qualified witness and this was within her ken. You know, she could offer testimony like this. The other ground on which counsel was not deficient, there were multiple grounds, but another ground was that she elected, instead of objecting to the testimony, which is sensitive business, of course, when a juror is asking a question, you don't necessarily want to be blamed for not giving the juror the answer to that question. She, instead of objecting, she engaged some cross-examination in which she found that the witness could not remember where she had gotten this information from, which would have decreased her credibility somewhat in the eyes of the jury. So those are reasons why, in this case, it's the court decided that even if it had, even if an objection had been raised, that it would have denied the objection. I think there's basis for that. There's a sound foundation for it, and so counsel was not ineffective. We're not here reviewing it, you know, from the perspective of a motion to introduce expert testimony from the state's perspective. This is strictly ineffective assistance. And I should add, too, that the court also addressed the core issue in this case and said that he wouldn't have granted an objection to the testimony because it wasn't Hazeltine evidence, because it didn't go to whether this witness was telling the truth or not.
Couldn't the defense attorney also, though, have asked for a hearing ahead of time so they would understand where the what the statistics were and whether they were supported or not, and at that point could have questioned the witness and maybe determined that she didn't remember what the studies were?
Well, I mean, that's certainly something that she could have done. And but the question here is whether her performance was so poor that she wasn't acting as adequate counsel constitutionally. So, and I think that the way that she handled it wasn't inadequate constitutionally. And so, and there was, you know, even if she had requested such a hearing, it might not have been granted. You know, the judge might have said, well, it's just one question. It's within her qualifications. She's, you know, she can answer the question.
Isn't there a little trouble with that, though? Because it's a little, as pointed out by Justice Bradley, it's a little sticky because it was a jury question. If you normally had known that this testimony was coming, you would be prepared as a defense attorney to better cross-examine, but without knowing that this type of evidence was coming in, you may not have at the ready the types of questions that you would ask. So that puts the defense attorney in a little bit of a spot.
What I hear from your question is that the defense attorney was put in a difficult spot. And what that says to me is that it's not obvious what the defense attorney should have done in that circumstance. And so, and that's the constitutional standard, is, you know, was she performing in a way that was inadequate constitutionally?
Well, with regard to the you know, any kind of Daubert-like objection, that wasn't raised or argued to us at this point, right?
Right, right. Yeah. Well, it was raised in the circuit court. It was raised in the Court of Appeals.
Just but not I think, renewed here, I don't think.
Yeah, here I would argue that that grounds for objection was forfeited by not raising it in the response brief.
You indicate, counsel, that of import in response to question from Justice Hagedorn, of import here is in certain circumstances whether or not the doctor examined and it was only one case that there was a false report, those were important elements to consider. At the outset, you said statistical evidence alone doesn't direct the answer.
Correct.
But, okay, where do you draw the line? How about in the 20 years of experience of the doctor, that there were two false reports, or three, or four, or five. You get my point.
Sure.
Where do you draw the line?
I think that if you're dealing with statistical testimony alone, the question is whether it's never, and whether the opinion is never. So what I mean by that is, let's suppose theoretically that there were some study that said that this never happens. You know, based on the data set, you know, they looked at 500 cases and there were no false reports. And so the response was zero. Okay. Now, if the expert testifies, based on this report, my opinion is that this never happens, that there is never false reporting, then I think that that would constitute vouching for the credibility of the witness. But if this theoretical, and I'm sort of anticipating what I thought a question would be, and this is essentially where you were going with this. If there's a study that says that it hasn't happened on this data set, 500, whatever that's surveyed, no false reports. Instead, the witness says, well, this is what the survey says based on 500 reports, but doesn't offer their own opinion that it never happens, then I think that that leaves open the possibility that it does happen. And one would hope this is very theoretical, of course, because the research that I indicated in that footnote shows that it's between 3 and 8%, essentially, or 2 and 10%, based on the accepted reports. So it's a hypothetical that's, I don't think, is realistic. But so I haven't talked at all about prejudice. If this court, well, first of all, I just wanted to say that as regards to ineffective assistance, because there wasn't well-established law in 2019, same date as the Mader case, I think that's pretty clear. I mean, when Mader comes out and says, that day is today, we're going to decide this issue, it is announcing for the first time that this particular kind of testimony, this statistical testimony alone, constitutes Hazeltine testimony if it is 8% or below. So I think that you can't say that that was well-established law in 2019 during this trial, and so counsel was not ineffective for not raising an objection on the grounds that have been argued before this court. So I would also argue about prejudice. If you were to conclude against the state on the first two issues, I don't think that that the defendant can meet his burden as to prejudice. That is a reasonable probability of a different outcome. Because of the reasons that are set forth in my brief, yes, the Court of Appeals said that this case was, the evidence was in equipoise. I strongly disagree with that. I strongly disagree with that characterization. The jury, if the evidence really was in equipoise, that is, if everything that the jury considered, that is, the credibility of the witnesses that testified before it, including the credibility of the victim in the forensic interview, if they really thought that the evidence was in equipoise, they would have acquitted. They did not. They considered the credibility of the witnesses in this case based on the extensive, again, instructions that are provided to the jury. And so I would argue that to conclude at this point that there's a reasonable probability of a different outcome minus this evidence, taking a look at everything on the whole, I think essentially changes the outcome on a cold record.
I have other issues with the Court of Appeals opinion. I'm wondering if you share those with me, and particularly I'm looking at paragraphs 40 and 41. And I got to tell you, as someone who spent 8 years going to judicial conferences and training judges on the victimization of domestic violence and sexual assault victims, these two paragraphs take my breath away. The Court of Appeals in paragraph 41 says, the sexual assault allegation was not independently corroborated by other evidence. Oh, you have experience in these cases too, I know. I mean, right?
It is unusual in a child sexual assault case to have corroboration by other evidence, right?
I think it's also unusual in a court of appeals opinion in 2024 to rest your opinion in part on that conclusion, because in most of these cases, you don't have independent corroborating evidence. I mean, especially child sexual assault, where there's delayed reporting, you're not going to find independent, just like you're not going to find biological evidence.
Right. And the perpetrator knows what the perpetrators know.
Right.
The next one is the one that, if the first one took my breath away, I mean, the second one like almost landed me in the ICU. And that is, there was only one sexual assault that occurred during a one-year period. So now the Court of Appeals, and it is telling everybody else who reads this opinion that if a sexual assault victim only comes forward with one allegation, they are not to be believed.
Right.
I don't even know what to do with this, except to scream from the rafters, which is apparently what I'm practically doing right now.
You're definitely yelling.
Definitely yelling, yeah. Take So that again, and then the third part about her story changing over time, right? What do we know about people who have undergone traumatic experiences? And I know you're familiar with this as well.
Especially if it happens when it happened when she was 8 or 9, it's not unusual for the story to change over time. I mean, that's the nature of memory. That's just, it's a poor basis on which to conclude that, you know, she's somehow not credible or something.
Especially someone who has gone through a traumatic event, correct?
Exactly, yeah.
They remember things. They need time and space. And it would probably raise your eyebrows if her story were completely consistent every single time she told it, correct?
May I respond, Chief Justice?
Yes, you may.
Yes, I completely agree.
So I'm just going to finish here, Chief, if I could just ask one more question, please. And so looking at Chapters 40 and 41 and analyzing the prejudice prong, the way the Court of Appeals, in addition to what you said, I think you would agree that these are also deficient reasons to find the prejudice the way that the Court of Appeals did.
I would agree.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice, this opposing counsel. May it please the court and opposing counsel. My name is Robert Maxey, and I represent Jobert Moldy. This is a case about a juror asking for and receiving an answer regarding a child's propensity to tell the truth when reporting sexual abuse from an expert witness directly involved in treating the complainant. That expert's answer effectively stated to the jury that 99% of all child sexual assault reports are true. The state then hammered this home in closing arguments on multiple occasions.
Did the expert in this case ever meet the victim?
As far as the record shows, it's unclear. She supervised in real time is what she told the jury when asked.
Did she testify at trial that she had met the victim or knew the victim?
She did not. All she said is she responded that she supervised in real time the forensic interview and that the nurse practitioner was reported directly to her.
Do you draw a distinction in this case between the testimony of an expert witness or the testimony of a lay witness when it comes to vouching?
I do. I mean, obviously, the case law states consistently that with expert testimony, you have a lot more harm that can be done. I mean, you have the aura of scientific reliability that permeates from this testimony when jurors hear it coming from an expert, I think it does a lot more damage than from a lay witness.
So you think that a lay witness then can testify about whether or not they think another witness is telling the truth?
I think the case law is clear that neither an expert nor a lay witness can testify to the credibility of another witness.
Right. So it would be improper in this case if an expert witness or a lay witness testified as to whether or not they thought the victim in this case was being truthful when she testified, correct?
Absolutely.
So I find it surprising then, given that, that on page 39 of your brief, you say that the members of Moldy's family also express doubt about her allegations. It sounds to me like on one hand you're okay if they do it, but it's not okay if the expert witnessed. If you're saying that it's okay for these lay witnesses to offer an opinion about her, to testify about whether or not they thought she was being truthful.
The family members were never asked directly whether they thought that the complainant had a character for truthfulness. They were asked about the complainant's story.
And the expert was never asked whether or not the expert thought, the expert did not offer an opinion as to truthfulness. What you have in your brief is all six members of the Moldy family also expressed doubts about her allegations.
They were asked questions about her story, the complainant's story, and whether there was any inconsistencies involved in the story. And so they were responding to those questions. If there's differences in her description, if there's differences in the number of assaults that she alleged in these conversations, I will point out the fact that the only witness identified by the complainant was her younger sister. Her younger sister was pulled out of class immediately and told the investigators that this never happened. Everything that her sister said, none of those details were accurate. She also testified to that at trial as well. So the only witness that the complainant identified as being there for these assaults and had knowledge of these assaults completely denied that these assaults occurred.
Suppose that where either the stats here were different or maybe we're in a different context of a crime, and the statistics showed that memories are faulty, and 60% of the people in a given, again, assume it's a different circumstance, that 60% of the only 60% of the memories are true, and that you have a 40% sort of false memory rate in a given context. Do you think that would be the kind of expert testimony that a defense could offer in that situation?
Yes, I believe they could counter with their own defense expert.
Not counter. Do you think they could affirmatively just offer it? I'm not saying there was other. Let's put aside the fact whether any question was asked by the jury, again, different factual context, or there was any affirmative evidence presented on the other side. Do you think the defense could present that kind of statistical evidence in a given context via, say, expert testimony?
I'm sure there would be a Daubert hearing beforehand, and if they could demonstrate that it's reliable and it's based on scientific methodologies that are approved and, accepted in the scientific community, I agree that they could bring forth that testimony.
What if it was 80%? Do you think the defense could still offer that? That one in five are perhaps not telling the truth?
We're here on a case involving 99%.
I know. Just stick with me for a moment.
Okay.
What about 80%?
I would say yeah.
Okay.
I would say that testimony could be permitted.
What if it's 90% and offered by the state?
And we're still talking strictly memory?
We're still talking false memories in a given criminal context.
I would once we start approaching near mathematical certainty, that's when we start having issues, and I think context is key. And I think if we're linking it, this is general statistical testimony.
Yep.
I would say that. Yeah,
so general statistical. Okay. So state can offer it at 90%. Can the state offer 95%?
That's the question. Is that we're approaching a threshold that it gets a little more. Once we start approaching mathematical certainty, I think I would say statistical testimony in general should have no place in criminal courts.
I thought you just said it was totally fine for the defense to offer it if it was at 60%.
Yeah, neither.
Or 80%.
I would say that we're focusing here on credibility testimony. And
right, but I'm talking about statistical evidence. So if you're fine with the defense offering statistical evidence that, say, in a given criminal context, again, let's suppose it's outside of child sexual assault, and where a prevalence of false memories are much higher, for example, statistically, that would be totally fine, totally appropriate expert testimony to offer. Now, you'd be fine if the state offers it, if it looks pretty good for the state, but just not if the stats are really good for the state. It seems really odd to me that that whether evidence is admissible turns out as to, like, how good of evidence it actually is in a circumstance. The defense gets to offer it if it's good for the defense. The state gets to offer it if it's pretty good for the state, but not if it's really, really good for the state. That is, that statistically, it's very like they're very likely to not be making things up. That seems like a very odd evidentiary standard to make. If we're saying that statistical evidence can be helpful to a fact finder, which is the prerequisite, and again, let's assume it's reliable principles and methods, right? In that you pass Daubert, and you know the district court exercises its role as gatekeeper. That if we presume that evidence is helpful to a fact finder and not supplanting the role of the fact finder, that it shouldn't matter what the number is, as long as it's reliable evidence.
My response would be I would backtrack, and I would say that most recently this court has commented on social science and the issues, inherent issues with social science and statistics.
I think it's done so in the context of whether that can be the ground for constitutional claims. But when we're talking about what evidence can be presented to a jury, I'm not aware of anyone on this court suggesting that evidence that's the product of reliable principles and from an expert that relates to scientific disciplines is impermissible to present to a jury.
I would agree. I mean, the expert, Dr. Swenson, in this case, offered that 97% of all child sexual assault cases do not show signs of physical abuse. There's no physical indicators. So that's very similar to, I mean, we permit statistical testimony on these scientific matters. And so I'd agree. If it passes Daubert, it should be permitted.
But just not if it's greater than some number that looks too good for one side?
I think if it's a comment on credibility. If the statistic goes to veracity, to credibility, to truthfulness, directly, I think that's where the issue arises.
That doesn't make any sense, because on the one hand you're saying that this victim was not credible because there wasn't physical evidence, or at least according to the Court of Appeals, that's true. That has to do with their credibility, and you just gave the 97% statistics. But I got to tell you what I don't understand is, why are we so afraid of the truth? If jury trials are supposed to be searches for the truth, why are we so afraid of the truth? Look at the cases that you cited starting on page 27 of your brief, where you give the statistics given in other courts. You talk about an 11th Circuit case. The prosecution expert testified to the jury that 99.5% of child witnesses in child sexual abuse cases tell the truth. You cite a Delaware case. The prosecution's expert testified that 99% of child sexual assault complainants tell the truth. You testify. You write about an Arizona case. The prosecution's expert testified that 99% of supposed child sexual abuse victims tell the truth. You talk about a California case. The prosecution's expert testified that the prevalence of false reports of sexual assault in child sexual abuse cases is as low as 1%. You talk about U.S. v. Brooks, the rate of false allegations is approximately 5%. The expert further explained that the rate of false allegations drops even further, and the general sense of that in the divorce business, where they tend to occur at the greatest frequency, is 2 to 5%. You talk about another California case, People v. Wilson. The prosecution expert testified that allegations of sexual abuse occur very infrequently. The expert specifically noted that a, quote, classic Canadian study found that 96% of children accusing a person of child molestation were telling the truth. You go on. State v. Wilson, Missouri case. An expert witness testified that very rarely do child lie about sexual abuse, and that such incidence of lying among children is very low, less than 3%. I think that pretty much covers it. Why are we afraid of the truth? And this is what clearly, over and over and over again, in court after court after court, these are what the statistics show.
The state's two meta-analyses that it cites does not include 99%. And all the courts that you cited found that those expert witness testimonies were improper vouching, constituted improper vouching testimony.
That's not my question. You've been involved in a lot of criminal cases, right? What other criminal cases do we even ask the question? How do we know? What's the percentage of time that someone makes a false report? I've been involved in criminal cases 30 years, I think more now. You don't hear about it in convenience store robberies, right? I don't hear about it in white-collar crime cases. You only hear about it in these types of cases where children are the victims of horrific crimes. And in these cases, we are learning, because of all the statistics of all these experts that you listed in your brief who testified to this, that that's actually what the truth is. The truth is that the incidence of false reporting in these cases is incredibly, incredibly low. And that's the truth.
I think we see from the studies that there's a wide range that is being provided by these experts, and I think that demonstrates a bad habit of making up statistics.
These experts are making up statistics.
That is my argument, yes.
That the experts that you cite in your brief, that every single one of those that I just went through, they all made up the statistics that they testified to? That's your argument?
Saying they have a bad habit of making up on the spot statistics.
What evidence do you have that any of the experts who testified to the very low incidence of child sexual assault victims making false allegations?
I think when Dr. Swenson was asked to cite any study, she was unable to.
Counsel, I want to follow up the line drawing that was advanced by Justice Hagedorn and the concerns, 98, 99, 92%. You rely on the Morales-Pedrosa case. Did that case, in your opinion, identify any boundaries for statistical testimony?
It did, Your Honor, and specifically in paragraph 25, the Court of Appeals, in this published 2016 case that came 3 years before Moldy's case, expressly stated, and I quote, "Further, general testimony that 90% of children claiming to have been abused or telling the truth would have had less impact on the fact finder and be, this is important, less obviously objectionable than testimony that 99.5, 98%, or even 92 to 98% are telling the truth."
What do you take from that opinion's statement that indicates we save for another day this issue? Do you just set that aside? They didn't set any boundaries? They didn't intend to set any boundaries by the language that you quote?
I think the Court of Appeals is very careful to identify specific statistical testimony that it identified as clearly objectionable. And that testimony ranges from 99.5 all the way down to 92%.
Shouldn't we be careful too, counsel? What business do we have picking which statistical number is when we're talking about the truth, why are we so worried about what the number is? Isn't your better argument to us about context? Isn't that really what we're talking about here? And shouldn't we be framing this case in the lens of, is this the type of case, given not just the percentage of frequency of false reports, but also how the question was asked, the relationship of the person giving the testimony to the victim, and whether they had actually interviewed them, whether they were putting it in their own personal context. Some of these cases you cited to us, these people said, in my experience, I only knew one person that ever gave false testimony, and they were the ones that interviewed the victim, and then they gave the opinion. So, aren't those the things that this court should be doing, as opposed to trying to pick between a percentage or a half a percentage in determining what the law is?
I agree with that, Your Honor. I think that's absolutely correct.
Okay, so why? So tell me, and why for you, in this case, when Dr. Swenson never met the victim, The prosecutor didn't elicit the testimony. It wasn't put in the framework of her discussing all about the victim and then saying, and victims only testify falsely in 1%. It was a jury question asked later. Why would this be the case? Why is this the context that we would say this is impermissible vouching?
First off, I think it's important that this question came directly from a juror who was basically asking for this expert to comment on the credibility. Give us, what are the chances that this child is telling the truth? It's basically,
so you don't like that it was a juror question?
No, I'm saying that makes it more significant.
Why?
Because it's someone who's going to be making the final decision on credibility.
Well, they're making the final decision regardless. This isn't the prosecutor trying to put in something impermissibly. This is the jury wondering because they see a kid, and there's probably people that think that kids lie all the time and that they make this stuff up, which looks like they don't. But I don't understand why the jury asking it makes it worse. Seems like it makes it better.
I believe it's on the jury's mind. And then during closing argument, the state hammered home Dr. Swenson's testimony, telling the jury that Dr. Swenson basically told you and effectively told you and essentially told you that this child, the likelihood of this complainant lying, there's a very small chance. And
well,
I think that who else in the courtroom would this testimony apply to other than the complainant? I think that is the big question.
Counsel, I'm sorry, go ahead, finish your statement.
I'm done.
Okay. I want to bring this back to the posture in which this case is presented to us. This is basically an effective assistance of counsel, is your argument. So we have to determine whether the law was settled. And just listening to all the questions that my colleagues are posing to you indicates that it is indeed not settled. The Court of Appeals has made some prognostications, perhaps, about what this type of case, how it might be decided. But it wasn't settled law. So if it's not settled law, and I think you acknowledged that in your briefing, that it is not settled when you cite directly from the Morales-Pedrosa case, the court left for another day the question of what type of statistical testimony might effectively constitute improper vouching. To me, that's a concession that it wasn't settled. Therefore, counsel did not have an obligation to address that question.
Yes, I can, Your Honor. Hazeltine has been the law of the land in Wisconsin for nearly 40 years. And Hazeltine says no witness can testify to another witness's credibility.
And no one did that here. We're talking about statistical testimony that is not related back to whether this child was telling the truth.
Testimony that has the effect of commenting. Effect.
Right, but the effect, that issue hasn't been decided. The Court of Appeals opined in this case, but that means it wasn't settled law. The prior cases simply talked about how that might be addressed, but it wasn't addressed in those cases. Therefore, it was not settled. You're asking us to extrapolate from a case that's 40 years old, but that doesn't make it an exposition of the law that was clear, thereby triggering counsel's duty to object.
I would disagree with Your Honor respectfully. Hazeltine is a broad prohibition against any and all testimony that has the effect of commenting on the credibility, veracity, truthfulness of another witness.
I'll try one more time, counsel, but what has the effect is the issue that hasn't been decided. Can you point to me the exact language on which you can rely in the Court of Appeals cases, Mader or Morales-Pedrosa or any other case that settles it definitively?
I think Morales-Pedrosa clearly identifies that testimony that's between 99.5 and paragraph 25, 99.5, 98%, all the way down to 92% is obviously objectionable.
It said it could violate Hazeltine.
I would disagree with your reading. I would read it as
not the reading. It's
objectionable.
Show me the language, counsel. Can you at least give me a paragraph?
Paragraph 25, second sentence. And I'll read it for Your Honor. General testimony that 90% of children claiming to have been abused or telling the truth would have less impact on a fact finder and be less obviously objectionable than testimony that 99.5 or 98% or even 92 to 98% are telling the truth.
But that's not resolving the question. That's the court opining about a case that was not presented to it. Those were not the facts of that case, so it's not the holding, right?
I would argue that the Court of Appeals is clearly identifying in a published case testimony that it is saying, under the right circumstances, in context where you're dealing with relationship, that it could trigger Hazeltine and implicate Hazeltine.
It could. Okay, thank you.
Counsel, you cite many cases advancing your position, and I think one of particular interest is the Arizona case, State versus Lindsay. And there the court indicated that courts should not admit direct expert testimony that quantifies the probabilities of the credibility of another witness. In other words, drawing a bright line rule. Are you asking this court to adopt that ruling, that similar ruling as the Lindsay case espoused?
Yes, Your Honor. But I would point out that we're here in Moldy. This isn't Mader with a 98% top level. 99%. That is what we're concerned with in Moldy's case. That was the testimony that was presented. That was the testimony that the state hammered in closing argument to the jury.
Counsel, I heard you say the state hammered it. I know what the evidence was that was brought in. Can you give me your best argument, other than the state hammering it in closing argument, that that testimony had a prejudicial effect?
I can, Your Honor. The first thing is there's multiple things. The first thing is that the juror who asked this question that elicited this 99% testimony also served on the 12-person panel that ended up convicting Gilbert Moldy. The second thing that shows prejudice is the complainant's story did change over time. And that was shown through the testimony of her family members, who identified several inconsistencies in her testimony, as well as through her initial disclosure to the school counselor to the forensic interview. There were inconsistencies. The other thing is the complainant identified that her younger sister was there when this all went down, and that she actually came down from Jobert's room to grab the complainant to bring her up. The complainant's sister, when asked about all this, denied it, said none of this ever happened. I think that's significant. There was no physical evidence. There was motive on the behalf of the complainant, the motive being that she was seeking attention, that she was self-harming, and that this was something that she was very resentful for, the fact that she was living at her grandparents' house and was not satisfied. Overall, I mean, Gilbert Moldy consistently denied that he ever committed these crimes. He maintained his innocence. The only evidence was the complainant's testimony and her allegation. And I would argue that those factors that I just highlighted, that would show prejudice. And I want to identify one more thing, is that the trial court instructed both parties that if any jury instructions were objected to, that they would not be read to any expert, any witness.
Any jury questions?
Any jury questions.
Right. Did anyone object?
No one objected. So counsel could have objected, and any question would not have been read. And no testimony
counsel
would have been
also
elicited.
Didn't know what the answer was going to be, right?
That is true.
But why would counsel necessarily object?
Because she knew any answer that would be given couldn't be helpful to her client.
And she couldn't choose to do cross-examination instead, which is what she said at the Mockner hearing.
And she wasn't prepared. I mean, she said she did zero Hazeltine research in regards to this kind of testimony. And she agreed that alarm bells should have gone off in her head when she started hearing the terms truthfulness, veracity, credibility, falsity. I mean, those are Hazeltine words that should have went off, and she agreed that she had no strategic reason for not, especially when the trial court instructed both parties that any objection would be sustained to any jury questions. She had nothing to lose to object to this question. Instead, she permitted it to be read.
I asked your opposing counsel questions about the statute, 90702, and the foundational requirements for the admission of this type of testimony. there was no objection based on those foundational requirements, which I think were not met. What, if any, import should we give to that in this case before us today?
I think both the state and the defense argued about Daubert and the fact that this testimony would never pass Daubert. But in the middle of a trial, the time has come where, you can excuse the jury and then hold a hearing right then and there. But the dynamics of trial going on, it's difficult for that. Counsel did not have notice that this sort of testimony was going to be elicited. So I agree that this could be a big Daubert issue, but there was never any notice provided to counsel to be prepared for this kind of testimony or to vet it in a Daubert hearing.
You think that this couldn't pass Daubert? Really?
99% testimony.
If it's what the statistics say, we don't. When we do Daubert, we don't look and see. You would ask the witness the questions about what studies they were based on, and if the study said 99%, why wouldn't it pass Daubert?
The state's only two studies that it cites do not include 99%. I mean, that Swenson's testimony is above the two studies cited by the state in its brief and sheet. 98% is the highest. And if you go through these meta-analyses, there's inherent issues with the meta-analysis. I mean, they're just collecting literature, different methodologies.
Isn't that the subject of cross-examination? Questions about meta-analysis, it doesn't mean something wouldn't come in. She might have testified 98 instead of 99, is what you're saying. But the rest of it would be subject to cross-examination, right?
Correct. And if you look at the cross-examination that actually took place in trial, it wasn't enough to nullify the power of someone saying 99% of the time children are truthfully reporting.
Going back to Justice Rebecca Bradley's question, the framework here, you seem to be putting an awfully high standard on what we should expect of attorneys. If ineffective assistance of counsel means the attorney has to ask every possible question on cross-exam and make every possible objection even when they don't know if it'll be granted or not. I mean, what are you asking us to change our standard for ineffective assistance?
I'm not. I'm asking Your Honor to follow the reasonable probability that the outcome would have been changed by
an
objection.
Well, that's the prejudice part. I'm at deficient performance right here. You need both, right?
Yes, correct. And
I guess you need one of the well. Regardless, let's look at deficient performance because that's what I was focusing on. I heard your argument about prejudice. I think some questions were already asked about that. I'm focusing on deficient performance. Are you asking us to change that standard? It seems like your standard's much higher.
I'm not asking the court to change the standard. I think counsel's deficient performance fits in the current standard. And I don't think the defense is asking for it to be raised or is asking for a higher threshold. I think if you look at what occurred in this case and the actions or lack of actions by counsel, I think it clearly fits within the current framework, the constitutional framework of Strickland.
Your opposing counsel referenced his footnotes in his brief. Heaven knows we all love those footnotes, don't we?
No one more than you.
What can I say? Footnote 7. I'll ask opposing counsel regarding his own footnote. I see your time is up.
It is up. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Chief Judge.
What page is that?
28.
Federal. Justice Bradley, did you have a question?
Thank you. How perceptive of you. Thank you. Yes, footnote 7 on page 28 of your brief. You indicate studies, 49% of respondents believe that women lie about rape to get back at their dates. You cited another report with similar estimates of false reporting and stuff. Of what import is this information in footnote 7 to the resolution of this case?
I don't believe that it's important to the resolution of this case, but I understand that this court took this issue to address more than just this case. So if you are going to talk about the why this sort of testimony might be admitted in the state's case in chief, this would be a ground, potential ground. I didn't put this in the brief, but I think there are other grounds, too, that it might be admitted on rebuttal. For instance, if the defense offers, if the defense is that they have an expert that says, well, you know, children, they make things up all the time. And especially kids these days with all the things, the ideas they get in their head from the Internet. If you had an expert that said something like that, then there's no question that this sort of evidence would be would meet all of the requirements of Daubert. So I have four quick responses to opposing counsel's argument. First, the state did not concede that this evidence would not pass Daubert. The state's assertion was merely that not enough of a showing at this point because of the posture that it came up. Second, at the post-conviction hearing, the judge said that if an objection that he normally instructs the attorneys when there's questions from the juror, if one of the attorneys objects, then he'll just grant the objection. Well, that's not what he actually said at trial. What he said at trial was, he said that he would allow questions from jurors. Court said that it would screen the submissions and decide whether to ask the question. After consulting with counsel, the court explained, I will determine if your question is legally proper. If I determine that your question may be properly asked, I will ask it. So he did not say that he would have automatically granted any objection that was made. Third, I think that that Moldy is, just like Mader, is misreading Morales-Pedrosa and alighting basically on a single sentence in that decision that says that this particular number would be more clearly objectionable. Well, looking at the full context, even that paragraph 25, it's clear that the court is not deciding the issue. It says so expressly in the next paragraph, and then in this paragraph it says, well, and cites this Oregon case that I cited in my brief that said that expert testimony of, I believe it's 96 to 98% of allegations are true, that was permissible because there was no connection between the testimony, between the statistic itself and the victim in the case. So, and the last point I'd like to make is that, yes, I believe that this line drawing is arbitrary. That's saying that I don't know of any other area where if the methodology is proper, if it's a proper question to ask, that admissibility is determined on the outcome, on the statistic itself. So I would agree with Justice Hagedorn's point on that, or not point, but the question that he asked. I mean, that you asked, Justice. If there are no other questions, I would ask that the court reverse the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you. Interesting oral argument. The case is adjourned. The court will convene after the courtroom is ready for us.